just a couple of minutes away from the bell and undo the end. I have planned poorly, but I think that by the end of Sunday I'll be back on track. All right, give you a little bit of a show and tell. This is a very much a miniature of the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone is another one of those 8-footers, although a lot of it's broken off, so it's, I don't think, currently 8-foot if I remember, but I think if everything was there, it would be about 8 feet. This is some papyrus from Egypt. So I'll give you a feel for that. We'll be talking about that some tonight. And then I think we can trust everybody with the top. All right, sweetie.
Now throw the Rosetta Stone and hit me right in the back of the head.
No, don't do that. I don't want to hurt myself. Okay. So this is what the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in. This is what they stored them in. And actually, I think it was like bat droppings or bird droppings. I think it's bird droppings, actually, because they were in the caves or anyway, some critters. And it ended up sealing the jars. And that helped preserve them for a long, long time. So, but these are the kind of jars that they were in. Some were broken, some were whole. So that's the reason that we have quite a variety. But we'll kind of hit on those just slightly and then come back around and do a bigger discussion. But the Dead Sea Scrolls took us back 1,000 years or more for the Old Testament manuscripts. That before the Dead Sea Scrolls, it was about 1,000 A.D. was the oldest manuscript that we had of the Old Testament. And then we started going to like, you know, 150, 125 or so B.C. With some of the age on some of the manuscripts. So that was a significant find. So I got to play catch up. And first of all, Barry asked a really, really good question about the cuneiform. How were those translated? And I actually got the answer right. It is an inscription, Darius the Great. Like I say, on this train route, he wrote this big, huge, had engraved, hit him with his foot on an enemy, but in several languages. And so they were able to take the old Persian and then from that do the translating. And that was like 1830s or so A.D. So here is kind of a drawing of that. And so, again, head on, foot on his enemy there. And so he just said, I am the greatest king. I beat up all these people. And he did it in all these languages so that everyone would know. So that is how we had cuneiform. And then there's some whole bunch of other stuff that's very interesting about that. But really is a little bit outside of the class because we don't really have, that I'm aware of, any Old Testament passages or anything really in cuneiform. So one of the things we're kind of working our way through writing materials, and thus kind of the appropriate thing with the papyrus, is papyrus comes from Egypt. It was the favored material of the kings of Judah and Israel. Thus, we didn't preserve any of those because those don't preserve very well. They get burned up. And even worse is that the early Christians liked papyrus. It was cheaper than parchment, in which the Old Testament the Jews were using for their manuscripts. But papyrus was cheaper, lighter, easier to carry around. So pretty much all the original autographs, everything, pretty much we assume was done in with papyrus. And indeed, the oldest New Testament manuscripts we have were papyrus. And they don't last too well. They last an amazing time, but still being used and all that, they don't last too well. This is actually from Epcot. If you ever go to Epcot, they actually there by the sea have an awesome papyrus grove. Or there, it's the most I've ever seen in one place. There's a single stock, but what I've never really seen a good picture that shows that it's triangular in shape. So what they literally do will cut strips, and if you look back at the papyrus, you saw those strips. That is that papyrus plant that's been sliced, and then they will go crisscross. They'll go back and forth, and then they kind of hammer it, and the starch that is in the papyrus sticks it together. And so the guy who was explaining all that was just saying how great papyrus was. But when you want it to last 2,000 years, not so good compared to stone. And like I say, we would not have had, in the particular case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, remember, it was mainly because those jars were sealed that they lasted. Plus, dryness helps. All right, so one of the interesting things about Dead Sea Scrolls is that they did find several of these inkwells, and not included in this picture, you might get it in a later class, but they had these benches. And so what they would do is they would take the parchment and then they would sew it together. And tends to be, what, about 12 meters was the maximum length that you just, the scroll was very hard to handle after that. And then tended to be at least 7 meters. Like, you know, if you go and say, okay, what's the canon, you know, name, description of the minor prophets in the Hebrew Bible? It doesn't say the minor prophets. It says the 12. And generally they are found on one scroll. So all of them will fit on one scroll, and they're called the prophets, the 12. Okay. Why am I doing this? Okay. I see you fighting there. Okay. Parchment. Especially refined by King of Pergama, because the Egyptians wouldn't sell in that, but was used for quite a long time. Tends to be more durable. It's kind of a process, though, to get it prepared. Tends to be sheep, goats, things like that. Here's how they would take, and it was all, you know, where was the hair originally, the skin and all of that. And they would do these four sheets and make a codex out of them. So this gives you kind of a feel like we're going to talk about Sinaiticus, and you get that feel from there. And what? Okay, maybe, I guess, y'all have to tell what one of your, there was a couple over there, but there was at least one individual who said, okay, explain this Daniel Roar's business. And the best answer is take the in-between the testament class that we ever offer that again. Because that's where we really, that whole class is based on Daniel and going through the intertestamental period. But anyway, just to give a little bit of feel, because we never made it there, is that they found, okay, oops, that's in the wrong place, sorry. Okay, when they dug up the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found these different manuscripts found in different caves. And what's kind of interesting is, like, Deuteronomy, there were 30 copies of that, Genesis 19. I mean, the Torah dominates. But then if you move from there, it's your Psalms, most quoted, right, in the New Testament, very much read. And then you've got Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then Daniel down here. So there was about 8 copies of Daniel. And several of the manuscripts contain chapter 11. Now, chapter 11 of Daniel is really unlike any other chapter in the Old Testament. as far as the level of specificity, the duration, and all of that, chapter 11 is just incredible. So most critics don't like that. And the number one way that you say, well, sure the Bible is right, sure the Bible got all these things, even though we know there is no God, thus there can be no miracles, there can be no way to foretell the future. Thus, the only thing you can do, if those are all your presuppositions, is to say it's all after the fact. Okay? So, 11 really kind of gets us to Antiochus Epiphanes, who went around, forbid sacrifices in the temple, circumcision, sacrificed pigs on the altar, and really all of the sects, the Pharisees, Sadducees, all of that that we read in the New Testament, kind of came out of that persecution of Antiochus and Epiphanes, and in general just the Greek culture rules. Thus you can't have any other culture. Okay? It's our culture or you're dead. Kind of mindset. So, and that, again, Daniel lays that all out. Now, Daniel is prophesying, this prophecy hits around when Cyrus just comes and say, hey, you can go back, people. So you've got several hundred years. And so what they'll say is, well, somebody came and added chapter 11 and 12 to Daniel after the fact. I mean, that's the basic premises. And so when you look at the dating of these, okay, you've got some that go, it's difficult. When you're dating these based on the handwriting, and they tend not to like them to do carbon-14 dating and stuff on it, you say, we believe it goes back to 150 B.C. And then some others kind of push back. Well, the Maccabees are, 120, 150. The Maccabee Revolt, Antiochus Epiphanes, you're about 160 B.C. So depending on who you want to listen to, you're looking at 10, 14 years to within 40 years after the event. Okay? So you got 40 years for someone to add all of that. It wouldn't have been the Essenes. And then for the Essenes to say, hey, this is a great addition to Daniel. We're going to make copies of the book of Daniel with these new additions. And you look, and you also see, and this is based on I have not read this anywhere. This is simply my attempt to look at what is said, hey, these are the books that are there. So, these are not with the Dead Sea Scrolls. First Maccabees, Second Maccabees, all the additions to Daniel that came about 63 B.C., that they threw in a lot more into the book of Daniel, which is in your Catholic Bibles and stuff like that. So, there appears to really not be a lot of Apocrypha later than the times of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, there are some, and those tend to date before this whole event occurred. So, if my analysis is right, which is just a lay guy looking at stuff, it would appear that the Essenes weren't really keen on all of these kind of extra Bible stuff that was being written after Antiochus Epiphanes. In fact, they were very upset with the priests that came in, the Hasmoneans, all of that. They said, these people are totally wrong. We're going to go live out in the desert. Although there was a community there in Jerusalem, they pretty well said, temple worship, all of that is messed up. It's not what God wants. So, if the Essenes tended not to take this extracurricular material, which the critics say was the fact for Daniel 11, then how can Daniel 11 be in the books of Daniel and having been read after 164? see the logic of that and stuff. So, and again, this could be somewhat wrong because I've never read it anywhere. But anyway, there is the oldest copy of the book of Daniel. I mean, we don't have a lot of it, but that is part of Daniel. And then the other problem, and it is after the prophecies after Antiochus Epiphanes is a little more difficult to place. But when you get pretty much to the end of that chapter, it does say, and he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious mountains. So, and again, you're kind of having to do a little bit of interpreting on that, but there are some commentaries who say, hey, that's Augustus, that, you know, he set up that whole empire, and it really kind of gives you a nice finish, because that has Daniel's 11 prophecies, Augustus, that's where it stops. Guess who was born during the days of Augustus? Jesus. And if you go back, Daniel says, hey, show me what's getting ready to happen. You know, we're going back in the land. What do you have planned for us, God? And in chapter 11, he does that, and he takes it kind of to there. So, if that is correct, the argument of the critics and Antiochus Epiphanes, it falls apart completely because we go on into Roman times, which would have been after the fact. So anyway, that's the reason Daniel roars through the 400 years of so-called silence. And you want, we really go through this in between the Testament, a little bit in the book of Daniel. Exactly. It's kind of fast. It really took too much time and the amount of stuff I had to go through. But you can ask questions or discuss after. Okay. What we're looking at today is the New Testament manuscripts. Plus, there's part of the transmissions and stuff of how that was done and what, you know, issues are around that. I really didn't get to any of that on Sunday. And if you really look at what I put together, I never intended to. So we still have some lesson four stuff that I moved to lesson five. So for the New Testament manuscripts, but we're also spending some time with recording, transmitting, and then we've got a lot of stuff about manuscripts. So some of the manuscript stuff we probably will carry through to Sunday, and I promise I'll wrap it up. Okay, so if you just look, we're kind of moving to New Testament times, trying to figure, okay, how did all of these things kind of get out in there? If you look at Roman culture, okay, not everybody could read, but there was definitely a significant part in literature, writing, all of that, very much a part of Roman Greek culture, even though a portion of the society reading wasn't on their tabs. And, you know, what you did is you'd have this scholar or this great writer who would write something. Now, he could have a real popular book, he won't make a nickel out of it, because you didn't have real, you know, printing companies who then sold. There were kind of booksellers, but it was like they could have a guy in the back of the building he was writing, generating the manuscripts. So there was no printing press or anything. All this was done by hand. And so the author would write it up. He's not going to get any financial. He may get some fame. He may get a sponsor after such a really great book. And he would send copies to friends or other kind of scholars. So the way it would be distributed, he would send copies, they'd make comment and things on that. And then what they would do is they would read it. In other words, there would be a bunch of people kind of come in and gather here, and the guy would read his manuscript, or his friends, you know, everybody kind of come together, they would read his manuscript, and one said, man, that's a really great scroll there. I want to make a copy. And so he'll pay somebody to make a copy of it. But what is interesting, and you don't textual criticism can really, you know, shut down your mind pretty quick when you read about it. Because they're talking about variations. So much of that is what that's involved. And it's good that there are people who love to do that. But the other component in textual criticism is realize, especially when you're talking about New Testament manuscripts. Now, some of these could have been done, you know, by someone paid. But some of these were written by Christians of that time period, writing these things. And also, you know, as we kind of have there, you know, Paul says, hey, when I, you know, Thessalonians, when you get my manuscript, you know, you read it. You read it now. Read it to these people. You go to Colossians and say, hey, folks in Colossae, you know, I'm sending one to the Laodiceans. You read theirs and you send yours to them to read. So, again, reading, very much a component. And one of the things I've read just really blew me away. That if you look at the text of these Roman dudes, these top scholars, brainiacs, intellectuals of the Roman Empire, you look at their writing and their, you know, what they were doing, there were very few margin guides or anything like that on reading. Okay, saying, hey, you're coming to a stop, you know, realize the sentence goes so far ahead and all of that. It's just not there. And so those manuscripts were designed for the reader so that the reader had to know that manuscript. The reader performed the manuscript. So it wasn't about so much the words, but how well the reader could read them and, you know, it was a performance in that. When you look at the manuscripts of Christian literature, lots of guides on reading the manuscript. So the purpose of the manuscript and those notes was to be sure that whoever was reading it read the manuscript right. It was the manuscript that was being read. It was not the reader performing. And until, you know, there's some really good literature that's been coming out in the last 10 years or so. And so these kind of descriptions are kind of giving, and it just gives you a total kind of different feel and a realization that these manuscripts, for the most part, were generated to be read, worship service, classes, teaching, but that the emphasis was not on the reader. The emphasis was on the text that was being read. And they picked that out by textual criticism. So, but anyway, so the fellow would, you know, send copies. Someone said, hey, I really like that, you know, copy me one. Booksellers, there were some booksellers, but you couldn't go in and say, hey, you know, I want that late, you know, Homer, I'm really, you know, my kids are needing to learn Homer for school. You know, do you have a copy of Homer's Odyssey that I can, you know, can purchase? Well, you don't necessarily go to the shelf. They don't, I mean, you know, they aren't all sitting there. That a lot of cases say, well, okay, I'll make you a copy and you'll have it in a couple of months. Or, you know, 2-3 weeks. It'll take a while to do these. So they didn't just make a whole bunch of copies. They would tend to make them by order. Although even given this kind of culture and situation, another author I read says that, you know, that fullness of time, then you take it in between the Testament. We all kind of, so much of the at least the class we did last time, a lot of the focus is looking and understanding how the fullness of time kind of came and looking at those developments. And not on that list, per se, is that the fact that you have the empire, that you're no longer the republic, no longer really so much the elites, that with the coming kind of empire of growth of government, more people were reading, more people were wanting to see the manuscripts. And so that actually there were much more writing and reading going on during the time when Jesus came, that 100 years, that whole period when Christianity is just blowing out. And that part of the reason you see that or understand that that's going on is the expansion of libraries. that you ever stuck seeing a lot of pictures of the city of Ephesus where Paul was? Well, there was a library that's still there. The facade is there. And built around 114 or so, 115 AD, kind of that time period. And so they built this huge library right there in Ephesus, hold 12,000 scrolls. Why did they need 12,000 scrolls? Why was that built? Well, Ephesus had a lot of people coming and going. That's the reason Paul was there for 3 years. But also, more people wanting access to be able to read. So, anyway, interesting. So that's kind of how it went. Now, when we think of someone of Christian literature, epistles, things like that, who's one of the number one people you think of as writing a lot of the New Testament?
Paul.
Okay. So Paul, write or dictate these letters. And so he was doing letters to churches, right? So church would have a whole lot of questions. Now, how do we just do these things? That, you know, how do we apply, you know, the teachings of Jesus, this whole New Testament, the whole gospel thing? How does that come in? Realize that a good percentage or a fair amount of some of his most active writing, the gospels per se, hadn't been written down, as far as we know. It tends to be a little bit after, but in that time period. So he would, you know, write these letters, like we say, the Thessalonians, you know, say, hey, have this letter read, so that, and then it would go to these individuals, and they would have copies made. So, you know, it's generally thought that, it was a general practice that you would keep a copy of whatever you wrote, so Paul would potentially have those copies, but they would then be sent and then be shared around. And as we said in Colossians, they said, hey, you share your letter with the Laodiceans, and Laodiceans share yours with the Colossians. So, again, he was all these different places sending these letters. So that is kind of most of the writings that we associate with Paul. Now, the other set that we have isn't necessarily going to a place, is it? You know, James isn't going to a place. Hebrews isn't going to a place. 1st, 2nd, 3rd Peter is not necessarily going to one specific place. They're generally called more general epistles. They're a little bit different type. But with Paul, we associate that. And I didn't write down, but again, one of the old, kind of at least a mentioned copy. I mean, within a very short period of time, you know, a manuscript that had come from like maybe Spain had ended up in Egypt. So that, you know, fairly fast distributions on some of these things. So the way to think about it is, you know, the original is written, copies are made and circulated, and then copies are made of that, then copies are made of that. And then what happened was there would be some places that would tend to collect. You know, you have these copies, so, you know, you could have had a copy, you know, set that was in Italy, and then that copy was down in Egypt, Alexandria, they would keep a copy of that. So they would have several copies, and what tended to happen was is that they were sort of really, they don't call them that, but what they are versions. That there was a Western version of some of the epistles. There was an Alexandrian, a Byzantine kind of version, so that there would be some differences in the copying, and so that one kind of set would be favored over another. But what was generally in a lot of them that are found, especially in Sinaiticus, you'll see notes on the margins. As these would come into the library, they would kind of note some of these variations. So, I don't know if you've ever gotten into a conversation, but have you ever heard or read some of the stuff or so such? You know, unless I have the original author, the original copies of Paul, I just can't believe that I have what was written in my Bible today. And some critics will say, it's impossible to have something written by Paul that got transmitted all the way to us today. Okay, so, you know, do we have any indication that those who were making copies by some miracle, you know, wrote it exactly, kind of became a robot and made a perfect copy? Do we have any indication in anything we see in the Bible to point to that, or any proof of such a thing occurring, you know, in any of the things that we found in the early church fathers? You know, reason to believe, well, you know, yeah, miracles ended with, you know, that first century, but the one miracle, the one gift that still occurred was the ability to copy the Bible correctly. And, I mean, and so that's, you know, again, so a lot of critics will say that. Now, what method then occurred to give us? I mean, you should have more confidence today than any time since, you know, the Reformation, since Martin Luther put his thesis up on the door, starting looking to say, hey, do we have the Bible? I mean, when that occurred, there was a whole sort of effort to make sure that the Bible was as it was written originally, because there was concern, because the Catholic Church had controlled the Bible for all those years, and so there was this whole big concern. So ever since then, you know, a lot of people ask, how can we be sure that we have the original text?
The writings of those in the first, second, third century.
They help. They help. It is quoted, and I don't know that it's exactly correct, but you can pretty much recreate the New Testament from the writings of the early church fathers within 100 years or so. But they tended to use, like, they would even still, like, for the Old Testament, use the Septuagint, which is, of the versions, is not necessarily the best translation. So, how many have you ever heard? I think kind of in the readings and stuff should have hit. How many sort of Greek manuscripts do we have? Because it was written in the New Testament originally in the Greek manuscripts in Greek. So how many Greek manuscripts do we have?
Zero.
Oh, no.
Manuscripts?
Well, not original.
Okay.
From the time till they quit really writing in Greek. So Greek's the original language, so that, you know, if you're going to translate something, you want to translate from the original language. So if it was originally in Greek, your best copies are going to be in Greek.
Hundreds?
Okay. Thousands. Thousands. The number batted around is 5,300. Okay? So what you have is you've got that 5,300. And then we kind of push down a little bit. We're going to kind of go through and work the numbers so that the 5,300 sounds pretty incredible. It's really a little bit less than that, but you'll hear the 5,300. So kind of at least going back to the early church fathers is that Clement around 95 A.D., Ignatius 24, Polycarp 110. So they are very much, I mean, pretty close to when the originals were written, okay? It is feasible that there were some originals still around, although a lot of those were destroyed during the times of persecution. But 11, he mentions, Clement mentions 11, 24, so Ignatius hits almost all of the New Testament books that he'll quote from them. We know, okay, like, Luke, that Luke had been written when Paul wrote 1 Timothy, because he quotes the book of Luke. So how can you have a book of Luke without that? So there are, you know, okay. So you look at the Gospels versus the Epistles. What would you say is the biggest difference, other than the fact, of course, Jesus is alive, which is actually the reason there is a big difference. But what did Jesus do a lot of?
Quoted the Old Testament.
Quoted the Old Testament a lot, yes. Yes, he did.
Miracles.
Miracles. Okay, you got the problem. In one sense, I hate spending time, and I could spend a whole lot more time. But we don't really spend a lot of time because their presuppositions are issues. It really is an issue. So when you read a lot of the modern Bible language books, stuff like that, realize, you know, and when you're reading these, look to say, okay, does this guy believe in miracles? Does he believe in a supernatural being? Because if he doesn't, the Gospels is a really hard time, right? Because miracles says supernatural. So, and I have a hard time getting my head around this, but they say, because the Gospels are so miracle-headed, those all had to have been written in like 90 AD and after. Okay? At least 70 AD and after. Because, A, you got to have enough people dead from 30 AD that no one's around when someone writes, Jesus did this miracle. Okay? So they got to have that. So you got to have time. You got the other problem because Jesus' Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. This temple is going to be taken down. Not a stone left on it. Okay? So, again, miracles don't occur. There's no God. All of that. Therefore, at least after 70 AD is when the Gospels had to be written. That's the logic based on those presuppositions. But now, some of these guys will say, yeah, Paul wrote Romans 50 AD. Why in the world would Paul write the book of Romans in 50 AD when the stuff talking about what Jesus did and all that was made up in 90 AD? And I will admit, I don't read enough of the material to understand the logic of that. But if you look kind of the datings and stuff, they'll say, yeah, Paul wrote Romans. And that's, yeah, in the 50s AD. Again, thus, it is that sort of disconnect, which means I try to keep my mouth shut on that stuff. It is enough so that at least you're aware of some of the logic of where they're coming from. Because so many of the people that have bought into all of that are, just as all the politics have gotten so vicious today, the people wanting to deny the Bible have gotten just as vicious. So just be aware of that, or if you haven't run across it. But those folks are out there. But okay, so Luke is quoted by Paul. Of course, they get around this by saying Paul didn't write 1 Timothy. I don't think I'd have to go back and look at that argument. But anyway, we know Luke had to be around because he's doing that. Okay, so we have 5,000 Greek manuscripts. The Codex, it is very likely, they didn't invent the Codex, but the popularity of the Codex came about because of Christianity. Christians really used the Codex. And there's several kind of discussions on why the Christians might have, and the one that I think is the best is it's Paul's fault. Okay? It's the Apostle Paul's fault. Because what you would do is, with scrolls, you kind of roll them up. And Paul wrote all of these books, right? Now, you could have put a lot of them into one scroll, but it's kind of difficult. So what they started doing, plus it's hard to find. You know, you want to get to Colossians. I want to read Colossians. Okay, I go through my scroll and found Colossians. Whereas with a codex, i.e. a book, is what we're talking about. You know, I could find it, right? We got all these modern tablets and electronics and stuff. In some ways, they're a bigger hassle to move around into books. At least for someone as old as me, it is. That I could get from one part of the Bible to another part a lot faster with paper, a codex, than I can with the fancy tablets. Although I can have a whole lot of versions, so I kind of like that. So that the thinking, or at least a possibility, is because I wanted to carry around the writings of Paul, read them, because, hey, they really tell me how to apply a lot of the gospel. So I want to have that. And so the Codex was the way that I could have all of Paul's letters together. And thus, the kind of the Codex. And at least some of these guys argue that if you look, and where we what we have is that we're going to spend a good bit of time on really, let's see, where, well, the Codex, but the Codex, oh, sorry, that's the leather, okay, the parchment ones, not the papyrus ones, but this little Egyptian town, really no consequences, they have unearthed all of these papyrus, and included in that garbage heap are parts of the New Testament. Well, when you look at those documents, when you look at the papyrus, which is moving us, we are so much in trouble, from like the 150s to the 250 AD kind of time period, 300 at the latest, really, that what we consider canon is written in Codex. Very few of the scrolls are canon books. That actually the scrolls tend to be the Apocryphas and things like that. But that when you look and say, hey, this is a book I think of in the canon, they're in the Codex. So there seem to be, by this kind of 150 time period, that when I'm copying the New Testament, I'm doing it on papyrus, which doesn't last so long. But anyway. So the early church fathers, we kind of hit. We got a lot of that. There are, because parchment was, I mean, it took a lot of time to put together parchment for a book. What some people would do is they would scrape it and they would write another document. So the palmoset is where parchment gets reused. But with a good bit of kind of looking at your eyes and looking kind of, you know, squinting and whatever, you can see the original writing. They didn't totally wipe them out. And so some of the manuscripts that we have in parchment actually are reused documents. And then also, 400s, 800s, they would have Greek scriptures that, hey, what are we going to, what passage we're going to read? So rather than having to go through all of that, they would actually write up, this is the passage readings we're going to do Sunday morning for the year. So that's a lectionary. Okay, so, So the oldest manuscripts are in unicles. In other words, all capital letters with very little spacing there. Barry, since you're the closest, that's the only reason we're choosing you, I assure you mostly. Can you read that little sentence that we have there next to no spaces and no punctuations?
God is now here.
All right. So, anyone else have a different reading?
God is nowhere.
Nowhere. Okay. So, you can see it is a challenge to write this. And so that's how they write. So we have 300 manuscripts that are everything, same capital letters, and they would take it and they would even, you know, continue. They would cut the word and take it to the next line. So it was always an interesting time. And I knew I wasn't going to be just like totally out of time. There, you know, in the class in the past, we have actually done that exercise. Then someone around 835 AD got smart and said, hey, let's do capital letters for the first and then smaller letters for the other. We have 4,200 manuscripts, but it's 835. So really, it's the unicles that we have the most interest, right? Because we're wanting to get back to that kind of earliest times, but, you know, these kind of help us a lot of times understand the art of transmitting. So, again, we have 5,300 manuscripts. Homer, the big guy, big literary dude, 643, just remember he never got a penny of royalty. So, another statement you might read, or someone says, well, there are over 20,000, eras in the New Testament manuscripts. Over 20,000. 20,000. Sounds pretty bad, right? 20,000 heirs. Well, you know, if you multiply, divide 20,000 by 5,300, kind of drops a bit. Okay? So anyone ever throws, says, you know, hundred thousands or whatever, realize they're basing that on 5,300 manuscripts. Time span. Okay, if we look at the oldest copy we have of Plato, 1,200 years. We look at the oldest copy of the New Testament, not the whole New Testament, but a portion. I mean, it's 50, 60 years. So, a very short time period there. And then if you kind of go with the critics who try to move everything even older, there's even less time kind of in between that. All right. I don't know that we will get through all of this, but y'all, a lot of your readings have that. We will at least pick up at this with the Codex Bibles on the main manuscripts, because we need to look at that. But we'll roll that in kind of to the New Testament canon, because those...